Now, you're probably wondering, what's Linda Moulton Howe doing on a Wednesday night? She's always on the last Thursday of the month. Well, the last Thursday of the month is Thanksgiving. And so we're moving Linda up a day. That's today. And she's got some incredible stories, including one when we come back about a strange sound heard around the northern Canadian area. A very weird sound. Linda will be back with us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Noy with you. We have an exciting program for you for the rest of the night with Linda Moulton Howe. She really has gone out there to get some incredible stories. And Linda, first of all, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving to you and all of our premier staff and everybody out there listening tonight.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the holiday season, and here we are. But you've got a great story about something very strange going on in Canada.
Yes, and it will help everyone if they go to earthfiles.com, click on this top story in the headlines that is titled, looking at it myself right now, Strange Pinging Sound on Arctic Seafloor, Scaring Off Animals. That's a key part. And why to go is because I have a lot of maps that will help orient about where we're going, and most people have never even heard of these places before. We're going 2,000 miles north of New York City. It is to a small Eskimo village called Iqaluit, populated by about 2,000 Inuit. The Inuit are a group of culturally similar indigenous people who originally were in Siberia and perhaps Mongolia until they crossed the Bering Strait to settle into Arctic regions of Greenland, Canada, and Alaska. For centuries, the Inuit have depended upon naturally strong water currents in special places called polynyas to be like their refrigerator, sort of, always full of seals, whales, and other sea mammals that have given them a year-round food supply. And the reason is that the polynya water's strong current never freezes all year round, even when the land around the polynya is iced over. And for the Inuit in Iqaluit, one of those always full polynyas has been 75 miles northwest of their village in the Fury and Hecla Strait. That strait is a narrow channel of water in the Canadian territory of Nunavut, which is west of Greenland. And this is the most recent, largest, and least populated territory in Canada. Around June 2016, fishermen from Iqaluit heard through their sonar a very odd humming, pinging sound. Fishermen also say they have felt the pinging sound come right through the hulls of their wooden boats. But no one knows the source, except the mysterious sound seems to be coming from the seafloor below. At the same time, the local Inuit reported that the Fury and Hecla Strait polynya was empty of sea mammals when it should have been full. And that meant something was upsetting the animals enough to scare them away from the polynya. So local residents reported to their legislative assembly member, Paul Kwasa, that throughout the summer of 2016, this strange ping or hum or beep in the Fury and Hecla Strait was scaring away their food supply. So the reports led to a request for the Canadian Department of National Defense in Ottawa to investigate. And on Friday, November 4th, not long ago, the DND released this statement, quote, "The Canadian Armed Forces are aware of allegations of unusual sounds emanating from the seabed in the Fury and Hecla Strait in Nunavut. The air crew performed various multi-sensor searches in the area, including an acoustic search for 1.5 hours, without detecting any acoustic anomalies. The crew did not detect any surface or subsurface contacts," close quote. Well, Nunavut Legislative Assembly member Paul Kwasa was born in one of Iqaluit's ice igloos 65 years ago. He's now Minister of Education in the Nunavut Territory, and he's responsible for the Nunavut Arctic College. Growing up, he was very familiar with the Fury and Hecla Strait polynya that his village depended upon for food. He is very puzzled about the reports of the strange ping sounds, and while the government investigators went out there and say they heard nothing, he talked to me recently by the phone and said his top questions are who or what has made the intermittent ping sounds that so many people have heard, and when will the sea mammals return to the Fury and Hecla Strait polynya, because they are the key. They are gone. Here now from Iqaluit in the Nunavut Territory of Canada is Minister of Education and Colleges, the Honorable Paul Kwasa.
This past summer around Iqaluit, we do get all kinds of different boats passing through up to the Northwest Passage. And this summer, we had two sailboats passing through our community. It went up towards Fury and Hecla Strait. That's where the sound apparently came from. Through their sonar, they started hearing this very loud ping sound. And right away, they knew it was at the bottom of the seabed that was making that sound. It was that sailboat that first notified our community that their sonar started picking up these very loud ping sound at the bottom of the seabed. And after we heard about that, our local hunters and trappers organization started hearing from hunters themselves also the fact that in that particular area around the mouth of Fury and Hecla Strait, in the wintertime, that's a polynya. It's open water year-round.
A polynya is open water that is surrounded by ice?
Yes, it's an open water that doesn't freeze over because of the current, where the surrounding is all ice except that particular area. It's a polynya.
And that's why there would be a lot of seals and whales in that open water around the year normally.
Yes, that's right, year-round. Normally, polynyas are the favorite places for marine mammals because there's a lot of source of food there because it's a polynya. It's strong current, and it's open year-round. Hunters go up there year-round hunting seals, whales, walruses. So it's a popular place to go for seal hunting. But this year, this summer, the hunters were saying that there's hardly any. And because you can't really hear the pinging sound if you're on top of the water without any sonars, the difference there being that there's no more seals. And sure enough, the other member of the Legislative Assembly, there's two of us that are from Iqaluit that are in the Legislative Assembly. My other colleague went up there by boat, and he experienced the fact that there was hardly any seals. And right away, we knew, because we have experienced similar situations like that. When ships are mapping the seafloor, they would put some kind of sonars around that area that they're mapping, and seals become agitated because of that sound, and they would move away. And that particular area also has an abundance of whales, like narwhals, and those are the animals that we hunt in the summertime. And this summer, there were hardly any narwhals. It's something that bothers us a lot because it's like a grocery store. We go out there and catch marine mammals to put food on their tables. Unless they take that loud ping thing out there, the seals are not going to be returning.
Mm-hmm. And, sir, has anyone recorded the pings?
Not that I know of, but we got the National Defense to look into that situation, but they informed us that ping sound wasn't there. I don't know what's happening. We will see later on if the actual pinging sound is gone by going back up there to see if the seals are back or not. And with that sound coming out of that particular area, it's been abandoned by sea mammals. And in fact, we're seeing a lot more sea mammals elsewhere where they normally aren't. So I don't think the food went away. I think it's that sound. So I don't know. We haven't really gotten a definitive answer of who put it there, why is it there. So those are still the questions that we have.
I wondered if anybody in oceanography or NASA or anyone has talked to you or any of your colleagues about other strange buzzing, humming, pinging sounds that they're investigating.
No, we have not. The only source of information that we got was from the Canadian National Defense, and that's all we've heard.
Minister Kwasa, is it fair to say that if there were not a return of seals and whales throughout this winter and to next spring and summer, this would be unprecedented?
It would be. It would be unprecedented, yes.
Okay, and so we have a mystery that will keep unfolding over the foreseeable future, depending upon what happens. And if by next, say, April, May, or June, that no animals have come back into this Polynya, we are truly in a mystery.
That's right. Yes, totally.
Have you, growing up in Igloolik, or anyone in your family, have you seen unusual lights in the sky or in the water in this area?
Well, I remember way back when I was a teenager, I guess. This has been seen a lot everywhere, where it's pitch dark outside, we're snowmobiling, and then all of a sudden you see, it's like a flash of a camera. It's 1 second of total brightness in this very dark night. And I've seen this a few times in my area, where you see, it's like a flash of pure white light in the middle of the night. We've seen these. So there's been, how do I say, different types of things that have been seen in the past. I mean, it goes way back. Inuit are such that we see all kinds of things here, maybe from another world. But there has been incidents like that.
What do the Inuit say about these bright white flashes of light in a dark sky?
It's another form of life out there. We have a very strong belief that, yes, there is other forms of life. I'll tell you a story, an old story, Inuit story. When we heard about people landing on the moon back in 1969.
It was July 1969 for the first time with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
That's right, yes. When we first heard of that, when the Inuit first heard of that, the Inuit just laughed at it because they said, we've been there before. We've been to the moon and back. So they're very conscious, the celestial out there, and they're very spiritual. There's life out there. They truly believe that.
Minister Kwasa, what would be at the basis of the Inuit saying that they had been to the moon before Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong had landed in July of 69? How would the Inuit have gotten there?
There's stories. I've heard stories of if you go to the moon, this is how you can get back to the Earth. I know the story. I know how to do it. Inuit were very strong. In fact, Inuit, even before Europeans came up to our area, way before, Inuit, they knew what was happening outside of the world, outside of our territory. Shamans were able to travel around the world and come back in a spirit form. So in a spirit form, Inuit have been to the moon.
Well, what you're describing, Mr. Kwasa, would be in the United States programs that the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, they've had programs in what is called controlled remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed some of the people who have worked in those programs. What you're describing from the Inuit sounds very similar, that they can be in a chair in an office, but they can access something on the other side of the world, out into the solar system, out into the universe.
Yes, totally. In fact, there are stories like back in the World War II, we still had shamans. And there's a story of the shaman who wanted to go out and go kill Hitler because something terrible was happening. The shaman, he went out of his body, went over to Germany, started looking in spirit for Hitler and couldn't find him. He came back to his body. He told his other men that he didn't find Hitler, but the other men asked him to go back again. So he went again through his spirit, found Hitler, and got him to kill himself. And the shaman said, we did it. I mean, here we are, not even part of the war, because we're so isolated in the north, and the shaman's talking. Soon afterwards, we heard that Hitler was dead. So there's all these stories that we have, and we share it.
What is the DNA bloodline of the Inuit?
I believe it's Mongolian, because Mongolians, when a child is born, they have a bluish mark on their rear end, on the top of their rear end.
Yes.
And we have that, and Mongolians have that.
And George, the reason why I ask him about his bloodline is that there have always been, in the work that I have done with people who have been whistleblowers, that there's some link between Eben or E.T., genetic manipulation of this planet, and that the Mayans were an experiment, and that the entire Bhutan, Nepal, Mongolian part of the world was used specifically for some kind of genetic manipulation, and the Inuit have always been very much linked to very strange things with having remarkable senses about the universe about them. This sound is something that is really bothering them and the animals. And one of the questions that I ask him, is it possible that Thule Air Force Base, the American base in Greenland, has anybody talked with anybody from there? And he said, well, it's 600 miles northeast of Igloolik. And so that doesn't make any sense either, that it would be connected. And when you look at these maps, George, there's nothing around. I mean, it is, Igloolik itself is 75 miles southeast of the south.
Yeah, it's almost like Siberia, isn't it?
Well, you are in that part of the world that where the Arctic Circle and the North Pole. And the fact that it's 600 miles to go from Igloolik to Thule Air Force Base in Greenland, the stretches there, that big Baffin Bay between the two land masses is huge water, and so it truly is a mystery. This Polynya has been providing the Inuit all of this food for centuries, literally. And suddenly, out of nowhere, that's the disturbing part, the animals left this Polynya. And he said they're going to go back in December and see if anything has changed, and then they'll go back in January. They're very concerned. And hopefully the animals will return, but they won't be able to tell us what is it that has been making this strange humming, pinging sound in waters that could be felt through the wood by fishermen.
What an amazing story. When we come back, millions of acres of forests are being gobbled up by fires. Linda looks at that story next. Okay, welcome back to Coast with Linda Moulton Howe. And, of course, Linda, being in Los Angeles a lot, fires everywhere. But this is a very serious subject worldwide, isn't it?
It is, and the real focus is the climbing ground-level ozone, in which the whole complex of fires, drought, and ozone are now becoming a really toxic mix for trees, plants, animals, even humans. On November 18th, not very long ago, the U.S. Forest Service reported that 2016 U.S. Forest Service surveys of dead trees in California increased by 36 million deaths just since May, bringing the grand total in California to 102 million dead trees during this ongoing five-year drought. More than half of that number were in 2016, reinforcing the alarm that trees in California and other parts of the U.S. and the world are dying at an ever-accelerating rate. The world lost 45 million acres of trees last year in 2015. The government says this huge number of dead trees is, quote, unprecedented in our modern history. Trees are dying at a rate much quicker than we thought, close quote. The majority of the dead trees are where drought and unusually high temperatures have been most destructive, in the southern and central Sierra Nevada region. But northern California forests are also dying at a high rate. The dead, dry trees become fuel for fires that are now coming more frequently in longer and hotter fire seasons. One forest fire in Monterey County the summer of 2016 burned for 2 months, making it one of the most expensive firefights in U.S. Forest Service history. On November 7th, just a few weeks ago, the National Academy of Sciences published a new study that found since 2000, there has been a 75% increase in forested lands with elevated dryness that will continue for decades, along with increasing hotter, longer wildfires. In November, over 30 large wildfires burned more than 80,000 acres in northern Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Alabama. The Georgia fire alone burned forest acreages equal to 9 times the size of Manhattan. 250 residents of Chattanooga, Tennessee were hospitalized with breathing problems. Scientists say all forest biomes on Earth now are actively dying. One longtime contributor to the New York Times, Jim Robbins, reported for Yale Environment360.com in October that there is a, quote, new ozone alert, a warning of harm to plants and to people. And Jim is talking about ground-level ozone. We need ozone up high in our atmosphere to protect us from ultraviolet light. But there is lots of dangerous, toxic ozone close to the ground from car emissions and industries, and it's increasing rapidly. An MIT study estimates now that ground-level ozone is causing between 5,000 to 19,000 human deaths every year in the United States. Ground-level ozone has killed $20 to $70 billion worth of potatoes, soybeans, peanuts, and tobacco crops each year for about the last 3 or 4 years. Ground-level ozone levels are continually rising around the world, and some scientists think it is an existential threat. So recently, I talked about all this with Jim Robbins, the freelance writer based in Helena, Montana, who reports about science and environmental issues for the New York Times and other publications. Jim is author of The Man Who Planted Trees and has a new book upcoming in 2017, The Wonder of Birds. Here he is now from Helena, Montana.
We're surrounded by this ground-level ozone. One of the problems with ozone, and the reason people don't pay attention to it, is that we confuse it with the ozone in the atmosphere, which protects us from ultraviolet rays. And that was a big issue for a long time because there was a hole in the ozone layer. Ozone is good up high and bad nearby. And so ozone, that's ground-level ozone, is a toxic gas, and it poisons every living thing, including us. Especially in urban areas, it's a big problem because one of the main causes of ozone is automobile exhaust that isn't burned completely. Sunlight turns it into nitrogen oxide and other compounds into ozone.
And Jim, back in the 70s, when we knew that Los Angeles, you could barely see on smoggy days, and there were these big campaigns to deal with the ozone smog in Los Angeles and some other cities. And somehow we got lulled into the impression that the ground ozone problem that used to be so acute in Los Angeles had gone away. Can you explain the disconnect between why is it that we in the public have not understood that ozone around us has been increasing and it is now a big threat?
Well, in the worst areas, like Los Angeles, like Houston, it's gotten better because the EPA regulates the causes of ozone, and we used to get up to 200 parts per billion, which is extremely toxic. And now the regulatory levels are 75 ppb, or parts per billion, in cities. But there's a worldwide ambient level of ozone that's everywhere in the world. And that has been going up, and it's not regulated in a general sense because they can't regulate it. They regulate it at the source, but they can't really do much about it when you leave the cities because there's no convenient way to do it. One of the biggest sources is Asia, Delhi and Beijing and other places that are growing rapidly and don't have much in the way of air pollution controls. So it gets into the atmosphere and it travels all over the world. It raises the whole global ambient level of ozone to now 50 parts per billion of ozone. And that's a lot. And the thing that keeps coming back to me in these kinds of stories that I do, whether it's about trees or birds or anything, is how little we know about the world. It's bad, difficult to study. There's not a lot of funding. But one of the things they think is going on is that ozone weakens trees and it makes them more susceptible to insects and disease and other things.
Especially fire. There was an article here where in New Mexico and the West and California, there have been increasing numbers of fires. And in fact, in the Albuquerque Journal on November 12, 2016, study says wildfire season worsening, global warming the culprit. This was a study that was done by the National Academy of Sciences. And this was done through the Columbia University Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. What they have found is that western forests everywhere are, quote, hotter, dry spells. They are longer, they are hotter, and they are causing the western forests to dry out. This is directly related to this increase in global warming, which the study is saying is connected directly to human cause in gas, in cars, and industry.
Yes, all of the trees on my property, 15 acres of ponderosa pine in Montana, died within 3-4 years because we don't get winters below zero anymore, which we used to get all the time. Insects that live on our property took off, and they killed every tree within 3 or 4 years. So that really prompted me to start looking at what was going on with forests in the world. And it's shocking. I mean, it really is shocking to see what's going on, what scientists are saying. And when you connect all of these dots, it's a very troubling picture. And I've been waving the flag trying to get people to pay attention.
Thank you for sending me the URL to the Motherboard article that is entitled Every Forest Biome on Earth is Actively Dying Right Now, an August 20th, 2015 article written by Becky Ferreira. She has a sum up sentence, quote, "Every forest biome on Earth is actively dying right now, and if this course isn't corrected, the deterioration of these valuable ecosystems will accelerate over the coming decades," close quote. What I wonder, Jim, if this is true, if all of the large forests are in extinction events, even if it's going to take the rest of the century, this seems to be one of the most serious threats to the entire global health that I've heard of.
Well, I can't argue with you there because trees play a fundamental role in sustaining life, not only their life and the forest creatures, wildlife and so on, but our lives.
Could you please go over some of the hard physical evidence that scientists have found and you have reported about in your work concerning which plants are especially affected? What happens to the ability to either bring up water or not? What is known of ground ozone impact on plants and trees everywhere?
There is one study that was done where the guy covered up part of the forest with tarps and stuff. And what he believes is that there's something occurs called stomatal stagnation. That is that the trees get weakened by this ground level ozone. And this is a toxic gas, and the trees get weakened to the point where they can't fully close their stomata. And stomata are little mouths on the bottom of the leaves that allow them to release water vapor into the atmosphere. What that means is that they can't close up, and they keep pouring water out through their system. And they've looked at whole valleys where in forests and realized that what's happened is the trees are releasing so much water in the atmosphere because they can't stop from releasing it, which they would do if they were healthy. So that's just one of the aspects of what happens to trees from exposure to ozone.
It isn't just trees. It's some of our most dependent upon vegetables, in which they know that ozone is now killing $20 to $70 billion in crops per year. Can you go into what happens with some of them, like potatoes, soybeans, peanuts, tobacco, and so forth?
Yes. Soybeans and peanuts are very sensitive to ozone. Some plants are more sensitive than others to this gas. There were potatoes that they grew in the Delmarva Peninsula of Maryland and that they can't grow anymore. They were grown for potato chips, and so they had to retire the type of potato.
What does the ozone do to the potatoes and these vegetables?
It kills the plant. It kills the leaves. They turn brown and get spots on them, and they stop functioning. One of the big things about ozone, it's intertwined with climate change. It's a greenhouse gas, but also what happens is because growing seasons are longer. I talked to someone today who told me that growing seasons in the Southwest are a month longer than they were 50 years ago. And because plants are growing longer, much longer in some cases, they're exposed to ozone for a much longer period. When it's warmer, there's more ozone. And so if there's a longer growing season and it's warmer, we're getting these record heat waves. I read today that 2016 was the warmest year on record.
That's right.
And so what's happening, that means there's more ozone being produced, but also the plants are growing longer in these longer growing seasons and taking in ozone longer. So more ozone and more time to absorb it. It's happening so fast now. Every scientist I talk to says, wow, we have just never seen. We're beyond the collective wisdom of science at this point because it's happening so fast. The glaciers, I've been writing about this thing called a meltwater stonefly that lives in the glaciers of Glacier National Park. The glaciers are expected to be gone by 2030. That's 13 years.
Entirely gone?
Entirely. There's 25 left, and they'll be gone within 13 years.
We can be at urgent levels, even if people are not aware of ground ozone as a threat now. And in fact, Jack Fishman, who is a professor of meteorology at St. Louis University, and you quote him in your article for Yale Environment 360, he says, after 40 years of research, how frustrated he is, quote, there should still be a global alert about ozone. Now more than ever.
Yeah, and here we are, and it's not even part of the political debate we just had. It's not even barely mentioned, maybe just because people don't want to hear it. I don't know.
There's another statistic that in the year 2015, the world lost 45 million acres of trees.
Yeah, it continues. I visited the bristlecone pines recently. Oldest trees in the world in Nevada, Great Basin National Park. High levels of ozone around the trees. They don't know why the levels are so high. It's a big problem, and these trees at the top of the world, ozone is weakening them, and now it's warm enough so that bugs are coming up that high, and we're seeing blister rust, which is an invasive species from Asia, which came over in the early 1900s from Asia, and has now found its way to some of these bristlecone pines very high in the mountains.
And is killing them.
Well, it hasn't killed them yet, but they know it's coming. It's scary, really. I think we need a task force at the highest levels to figure out what the hell's going on and to do something. as you say, the Science magazine, the title was Seven Forest Biomes in the World Are Actively Dying. Well, if that doesn't raise alarm bells, I don't know what does.
Scary story. Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is our planet. This is our spaceship in the cosmos that we are. We've got to learn how to have a cooperation with it and not be destroying. And in October 2015, Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency and formed a tree mortality task force. And the idea is they're trying to get more money for the safe removal of fallen and dying trees because it is becoming such a problem. It has to stop. And meanwhile, in the Southern Hemisphere, on Monday, only 2 days ago, in Melbourne, Australia, a rare combination of an unusually violent thunderstorm and plants caused something I had never heard about before. And it's called thunderstorm asthma. It killed four people. It caused breathing problems for some 2,000 people. The Ambulance Victoria took at least 1,870 calls in about 5 hours between 7 p.m. and midnight on Monday, November 21st. Authorities say that it was spring rye pollen in amounts that were double normal pollen count. And with these big, heavy winds, it was picked up, and all these people were sick. There were some people who staggered out of their houses onto the front sidewalks or yards and just laid on the ground waiting for ambulances to come. Jill Hennessy, who is the Australian health minister, said, quote, "Unpredictable weather patterns and the impact on health, I think, is a new emerging frontier for public health risks, and that could apply to the whole world. We're in a time of political revolution. We're in a time of climate change, and all of us need to become more aware."
Linda, so many things are happening on this planet. How do we keep track of all this stuff?
Every day, I think, when I get up and get a cup of coffee, oh, man, what is the river going to bring today? And it is now so intense, and that around and inside of everything that we are talking about in the planet, and including that strange ping, is this question. What is the alien presence that seems to cohabit with us on this planet that has been here for centuries? And in the next half hour, I have a story that comes from a whistleblower who has listened to Coast, and this one is remarkable.
Indeed, indeed. Linda Moulton out with us. Her website, earthfiles.com, and you can always email her, like next hour's guest show will be. Somebody emailed her listening to the program at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. As for us, make sure you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download our free app in your app store, of course. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com.
The Coast website is now streamlined for mobile devices. Great news if you're a Coast insider or simply want to enjoy our website on your phone. Visit coasttocoastam.com on your iPhone or Android browser.